All right, good morning, everyone. We're going to get started. I'm going to call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. We have a number of bills that we're going to be doing public hearings on. What I'm going to do, since I have Representative Carolyn Tomei here, and she needs to be in committee at 9, I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2312.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2312 comes to you from the Judiciary Committee. Holds a fraternal organization that is a charitable corporation not liable for any damages arising out of providing eyeglasses, hearing aids, or other medical devices to a person without charge. Applies to fraternal organizations only when they provide used glasses or hearing aids to a person who is at least 14 years of age and provided without charge. Applies only to eyeglasses provided by a licensed optometrist or ophthalmologist who examined the person receiving the eyeglasses and issued a prescription for the glasses.
Carolyn?
Thank you. Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, I'm State Representative Carolyn Tomei, and I represent Milwaukee and Southeast Portland. Thank you for hearing House Bill 2312 today. I'm presenting this bill at the request of the Lions Club members in my district. The Lions Foundation is a charitable organization that helps thousands of low-income individuals every year improve the quality of their lives with a special emphasis on sight and hearing. Members have been collecting used eyeglasses since 1951 and distributing them to members in need. Over 100,000 pairs of glasses are collected by the Lions Club and members every year in Oregon. Unfortunately, no Oregonians benefit from this program. All of the glasses collected here are shipped to other countries because the foundation has no legal protection in our state. They could be subject to lawsuits should something go amiss. House Bill 2713A will provide charitable organizations such as the Lions Club some protection from lawsuits so they may distribute these eyeglasses here in Oregon. Specifically, the recipient must be at least 14 years old. The glasses must be distributed without charge, and they are provided by the licensed optometrist or ophthalmologist who examined the patient and issued the prescription. In order to craft the specific language of this bill, advocates worked with medical professionals and trial lawyers in phrasing the liability immunity provisions. This bill comes to you from the House with a unanimous vote, both in committee and on the floor. Arizona and Alaska have passed legislation that provides immunity from liability, and now those states are distributing glasses to their citizens, and we need to do that in Oregon also. Again, thank you for hearing this bill. Its passage will help thousands of low-income Oregonians receive the vision care they need, and I urge you to move this measure forward. We have Lions Club members here today to give you more details about the program and to answer your questions.
All right, well, don't get off the hook yet.
Okay.
See if we have any questions for you. Any questions for the representative? Well, you're off the hook.
All right. Thank you so much. Off to my next committee.
All righty. And I have two individuals that signed up for this particular bill, Glenn Gilbert and Tracy Ullman. If you two would please come forward. And whoever would like to get started, if you'll give us your name and then your testimony, please.
Good morning. Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tracy Ullman. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association. Thank you for allowing me to talk today. As an acknowledged leader in primary eye and vision care in Oregon, the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association feels strongly that public safety must be paramount in all legislation dealing with vision and eye care in Oregon. In the process of safely dispensing prescription eyewear to patients, there are important factors to consider, such as it's imperative that a patient would receive a comprehensive exam to make sure that their eyes are healthy and to determine what the prescription is. Also, if the patient is diagnosed with a vision problem, it's important that the prescription for the eyeglasses be done correctly. And then, of course, patients receiving improper eyeglasses that don't match the prescription close enough can have issues leading to problems in driving or working, and that's especially important in children where they may not recognize some of the factors that are causing dizziness or nausea or other problems. We want to recognize the Lions Club and the Academy of Ophthalmology in working with us as we looked at concerns leading to this legislation. With more and more uninsured individuals and the vision cuts in Medicaid, we feel that this bill will address a need and ensure public safety. In its current form, the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association does not object to the passage of this legislation, and I would welcome any questions that you have for me today.
All right. Thank you. And Glenn, if you'll give us your testimony, please.
Thank you. My name is Glenn Gilbert. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Lions Sight and Hearing Foundation. Mr. Chairman and members of the Judiciary Committee, sitting behind me is just a small sample of the support that House Bill 2312 has from the 4,800 Lions Club members and many more Oregonians around the state. I'd like to just ask the Lions here today and the staff to please all stand just for a moment to be recognized for the incredible work that Lions do.
Thank you all very much for being here and in support and all the work that you do in the communities, not only with eyeglasses, but other ventures that you are involved with.
Thank you. I'm here today in enthusiastic support of House Bill 2312, and I urge you to support HB 2312 for a number of reasons. But since time is limited, I'd like to do my best David Letterman impersonation and give to you very briefly the top 10 reasons why you should support House Bill 2312. Number 10, and I feel like there should be a drum roll here, currently there are 643,000 Oregonians that lack health insurance, and thousands more Oregonians that do have health insurance do not have vision care that covers eyeglasses. Number 9, the need for eyeglasses in Oregon was magnified when the Oregon Health Plan dropped vision care and glasses for adults in January of 2010. Number 8, for over 50 years, Lions Club members in Oregon have collected used eyeglasses and distributed them all over the world, but as you heard Representative Tomei say, not in Oregon. Approximately 75,000 pairs of glasses are given away by Oregon Lions to impoverished people each year, but that's primarily in Mexico. Number 7, Instead, Lions Clubs in Oregon spend an estimated $200,000 a year on new eyeglasses, which is amazing, but nearly all 180 Lions Clubs in the state run out of funds during the year, and so therefore a number of people aren't helped. If HB 2312 passes, people that need eyeglasses will receive them at no cost to taxpayers, and that's a good thing, I think, as well. Number 6, if HB 2312 is passed, we will provide used eyeglasses only to Oregonians living at less than 150% of the federal poverty level, ensuring that only those truly in need will benefit from this law. Number 5, 2 other states, as you've heard, Alaska and Arizona, have passed similar legislation. There's been no litigation or health issues that have arisen as a result of thousands of people having received used eyeglasses in those two states in the past 8 years. Oregon should be the next state to pass this legislation. Number 4, dispensing used eyeglasses would require that an eligible Oregonian possess a prescription from a licensed eye care professional, and used eyeglasses would be dispensed only by a licensed professional. Number 3, HB 2312 has the endorsement of the Oregon Academy of Ophthalmologists and the Northwest Health Foundation, and we've worked closely with the Oregon Optometrists Physicians Association to amend HB 2312 to ensure patient health and safety, as you've just heard. Number 2, HB 2312 has the support of the Oregon House of Representatives, passing by a unanimous vote of 60-0 on March 16th, and anything we can get 30 Republicans, 30 Democrats to agree on in the state must be a good thing. And finally, number 1, thank you, sir. Number 1 reason to support HB 2312, your support of this bill will help Oregonians like Ariella Rodriguez of Northeast Portland find work. Living on food stamps and raising her disabled son, Ariella cannot afford glasses and cannot drive to work without them. HB 2312 will provide people like Ariella the gift of sight as well as the gift of dignity. Thank you for hearing this bill. We greatly appreciate your support.
All right, thank you very much. Questions for anyone on the panel? Thank you all very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
I want to see if there's anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 2312A. Not seeing, I'm going to go and close the public hearing. And even though the chair has been holding bills for work sessions, I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 2312.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2312A and Gross to the floor of the Senate with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 2312A to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And do we have a carrier in our wings? Senator Wissett will be our carrier on the floor. Thank you very much. We'll go ahead and close the work session. And ladies and gentlemen who are here with the Lions Clubs, again, thank you very, very much for not only being here today, for the work that you're doing with getting eyeglasses out, but we do know as a service organization you provide so much to your communities, and thank you for being here and being part of this process. All right, so now we're going to go ahead and move forward with the rest of our public hearings. If y'all want to stay, you're more than welcome, but if you need to take off, feel free to leave now. All right, we're going to go ahead and go back to the top of the agenda. We'll start our next public hearing, House Bill 3162.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3162A comes to you from the Judiciary Committee. It prohibits a court from changing a child custody, visitation, parenting, or support order if one parent is a deployed parent and the parent is in active military service.
All right, I have one individual signed up. I hope I don't butcher the last name too much. Mark Sansusi.
Mark Sansusi, thank you.
Susi.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about House Bill 3162. I am Mark Sansusi, the regional liaison for the Northwest for Military Families, representing the Department of Defense, working for the Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness. I'm not going to read, I know your volume, and I'm not going to read that testimony to you, try and just summarize. Essentially, in an environment where divorce rates among military continues to climb and has been as much as 50% for women lately, many divorced service members have custody of or visitation rights with children whose other parent is not the service member's current spouse. Many of these service members who are deployed away from their family find that many states do not consider the unique aspects of military service when making custody decisions. Absences due to military service can undermine and disrupt existing arrangements, creating stress on parents and children. Without contact with their children, deployed members are frequently devastated, and it degrades their ability to focus on their mission. Obviously, focusing on the mission is paramount. Inequities and other differences among states have contributed to such stress that since 2009, this issue has been one of the top 10 key issues affecting military families for the Department of Defense State Liaison Office, for which I represent. The policy put forth in the language in HB 3162 addresses all areas of concern related to service members in child custody. You should know that you already have provided a couple of the protections we seek since 2007. Those two, one of them is that you ensure courts do not consider deployment to be the sole factor in custodial decisions, and also you allow for the delegation of visitation and guardianship when the service member parent is deployed and members of the service member's family want to stay involved with the child during the service member's absence. This bill covers the other three areas and asks for your support in these three areas. First, in prohibiting the court from setting aside, altering, or modifying custody or parenting time from provisions of annulment, separation, or dissolution judgment involving a deployed parent until 90 days after the completion of the deployment. This, among other things, will allow the service members some time to decompress after often harrowing deployed circumstances, enable the returning service member to be better manage the circumstances and find themselves in and ultimately be better parents. Secondly, authorizing a temporary order modifying the terms of a judgment to reasonably accommodate the circumstances of the deployed parent makes sense and is in the best interests of the child, and providing the pre-existing judgment to be automatically reinstated upon completion of deployment makes sense because that provides the consistency so important in parenting. And third and lastly, charging the court to make reasonable accommodations to allow a deployed deployed parent or one whose deployment is imminent to use today's technology to provide video, electronic, or internet testimony in a proceeding is helpful when the deployed parent cannot reasonably fly from Afghanistan or elsewhere to personally appear. This makes sense because the deployed parent should not be penalized for serving our nation by a mandated absence he or she cannot control. I wish to thank the committee for your support on this measure and helping our military families, and I stand ready to answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
I had one, Mr. Chair. I guess the question is, how many families are we talking about impacting that are impacted by this in Oregon?
I don't have the numbers, Senator. I'm sorry. We know that it's bubbled up through the services to be enough of a problem nationwide that we're trying to work on at each state level to try and address that.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 3162? Not seeing anyone. We'll close the public hearing. Colleagues, we have paperwork on this. I'm fine with moving this forward if we're ready to go. So I'll go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 3162.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3162 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3162 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Mr. Chair, we do have in our stack a letter from someone from the South Sea and South Sea Law Office in Salem. It says, on behalf of the Oregon State Bar Family Law Section, in support of the bill. So I see, okay. A head nod that the Family Law Section supports the bill. So I just wanted to put that on the record.
Yep. Thank you very much for doing so. It is part of the record as submitted. And any other comments? Any objections to the motion? So ordered. And Senator Cruz, will you be our carrier on this bill? And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 3162. And we're going to go ahead and open up our next public hearing on Senate Bill 2463.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2463 comes to you from the Oregon Telecommunications Association pre-session file. It requires a computer technician receiving compensation a processor of photographic images, whether receiving or not receiving compensation, who has reason to believe that he or she has observed an image of a child involved in sexually explicit conduct, to report that fact to the cyber tip line at the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, the Department of Human Services, or law enforcement agency in county where the image was reserved. Classifies failure to do so as a Class A misdemeanor, absolves persons from civil liability, and who in good faith report an image involving a child.
All right. And on this bill we have appears Brant Wolf and Jennifer Nigel. If you two would come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. My name is Brant Wolf. I represent the Oregon Telecommunications Association. This bill was introduced at our request on behalf of our member company, State and Cooperative Telephone. Mr. Taylor summarized it quite well. There is a currently existing federal requirement that indicates that computer technicians are mandatory reporters of what they suspect might be child pornography. Our members serve mostly rural Oregon. Many of them have employees who go to customers' homes and help them with their computers if there are issues with their computers. They are, in effect, computer technicians. The currently, in Oregon, the federal requirement has criminal and civil liability protections for good faith reporting. There is no similar protection under Oregon law for good faith reporting. That's the main issue of this bill. I want to make clear that this is not a new reporting requirement. The requirement exists right now. We think the benefit to this bill is obvious to computer technicians. This bill came to you with no opposition from your colleagues on the House. It passed 60-0. There was no opposition at its hearing on the House Judiciary Committee, and we simply ask this committee to pass this to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And Jennifer?
My name is Jennifer Neagle, and I'm an attorney with Duncan Tiger and Neagle in Staten. I am general counsel for Oregon Telecommunications and also five of the member companies that serve the rural areas of Oregon. And as Mr. Wolf stated, the requirement is already in Oregon law to report. We're just asking to include an immunity for good faith reporting, and we think that that will enhance and encourage people to report.
All right, thank you. Questions, Senator Cruz first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For either one, when this bill passed the House, I received phone calls and emails basically saying this was violating constitutional rights. And I don't believe it is, but what would your answer be to that accusation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, I have two things. I would say, first of all, that the mandatory reporting requirement exists right now. It's already there and in place. Beyond that, I understand that instinct and that impulse. I really do. What we're talking about in this bill, the situations and circumstances of this bill, child pornography, to me, there's a greater common good that would override any kind of Big Brother type of concerns, which I have heard third parties have been articulated by some. And I guess that's how I would address that.
Also, this bill mirrors federal law, and there are a number of states who have the same reporting requirements and the same good faith exceptions.
All right. Senator Dingfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a legal intern who reviewed this and did some analysis and had, I thought, a really good question that I'd throw out to our legal witnesses here. Her question was the wording of reasonably believes versus reasonable cause to believe. And I'm curious if you have any thoughts on that. She thought it gave more discretion to the processor technician, and I'm curious if you thought of that while you were working on drafting this language.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dingfelder, I am not an attorney. I guess I don't know how to address that. I mean, I'm not sure what the issue is. Reasonably caused to be believed or reasonably believe, is that what you're asking me to distinguish?
Yeah, her analysis was that even if an individual didn't believe it was child pornography, there would be enough circumstances that the court would decide he or she should have, they would be guilty of not reporting. And reasonably believes, in her analysis, provided more cushion to what the particular individual actually thought he or she viewed in the photos. So I was curious if, we do have an attorney here, if that came up at all.
The term reasonable is in both of the original statute and the bill. I guess I wouldn't see the difference between reasonable cause and reasonable belief.
I don't know if our legal counsel has any.
Bill, your thoughts?
Chairman of the committee, usually when you use the term reasonable, it's an objective standard in the sense of reasonable person under the circumstances, as opposed to being under the subjective standard of relating to that particular person. I'm hard-pressed to think what the difference between the two is, in the sense that the court would look what the average person, reasonable person in that field would understand to be child pornography. And then in many of these statutes, what they do is, if it's in many ways there, the second part, if you report, you're free from civil liability and criminal liability. And in many regards, the civil liability can be a lot more onerous than the criminal liability.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So now that we've sort of muddied the record for the courts, I wonder, has this actually been an issue, or is it more preventive?
It's more preventive. One of the member companies asked me to draft a policy about what their technicians should do in the event they stumble across child pornography, and I think, again, this would encourage those technicians to report if they're immune from liability.
All right, so just a couple, I guess, follow-ups. It appears that currently there is a mandatory reporting requirement.
Yes.
So the technicians should be already reporting. And what I'm hearing is maybe there might be some hesitation on the part of someone actually doing what they're supposed to do because of the civil liability. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes.
All right. And regarding reasonably believes or reasonably cause to believe, the bill now, if I am reading over the shoulder of counsel, looks like it's reasonably believes. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, I think from our learned intern, staffer, would give more, let's say, comfort for the person as compared to being under a standard of reasonably causes to believe. Is that correct?
Reasonable cause to believe. Reasonable cause to believe.
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah. All righty. Just going through a little thing. Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair Krasinski. To either member of the panel, to your knowledge, has anyone ever been prosecuted in Oregon for failure to report and charged either a fine or have been imprisoned?
To my knowledge, no.
Sir, I've not heard of any such situation.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? All right, we're going to go into this. Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on 2463? Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing. And colleagues, let me just ask you if there's enough comfort to move forward, or do we want to talk about it a little bit? 2463. So let's go ahead and open up a work session on 2463.
Mr. Chairman, move House Bill 2463A to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2463A to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion. Senator Bonamici.
It may just be, and I'm just looking at the language, it was changed from reasonable cause to believe to reasonably believes. It might just be legislative counsel's editing.
Yep.
That to save words, I don't know, but I don't see that there would be a difference here.
I agree.
Mr. Chair, I actually believe it's less clumsy the way they have reworded it.
Yes. All right. Any other comments? Any objection to the motion? Not seeing any. So ordered. And Senator Dingfelder, you'll be so kind, I hope, since Leslie was our eagle eye on this one.
Actually, it was my U of O law school intern.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, even more so.
There you go.
An attorney in the making. If you'll be our carrier, that'd
sure.
be great. We'll close the work session on 2463.
We won't talk about the reasonable cause to believe versus reasonable belief.
Thank you very much. That would be appreciated on the floor, since we don't need to muddle the waters there either. All right, we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2685.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2685 comes in from the Oregon State Bar Family Law Section. It allows for termination of the attorney-client relationship after entry of judgment or other final determination if a notice of termination of files requires the attorney to sign the notice and state all services to the client have been provided.
All right. And Russ, why don't you come on up? Is there anyone else who's going to want to give testimony today on 2685? When you're ready.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Russ Lepetsky. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Salem, appearing today on behalf of the Family Law Section of the Oregon State Bar. This bill is a pretty straightforward law improvement bill that allows an attorney to withdraw at the end of a case when the duties for which they have been hired have been concluded without requiring that attorney to go through their time and their client's expense of filing a separate motion, affidavit, in order to submit to the court to accomplish that purpose. It allows the simple filing of a notice of termination of attorney-client relationship. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Questions? Comments? Okay. Don't see any. Russ, just stay right where you're at. I'll go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2685. And if we're ready, we'll go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 2685.
Move House Bill 2685 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2685 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussions?
I just have a question about fiscal.
Physical or fiscal?
Fiscal. I need to be reminded. I'm sure it's in the stack here.
It is. It's in the stack that was on today. They're all clipped together. There's no revenue, and then it says no expenditure impact on the analysis.
So the cost savings on efficiency to this would be to the client versus the judicial system, or both?
I would say more to the client. I mean, there'll still be paperwork that's going to be filed with the court that needs to be processed.
Less paperwork.
But less. It'd just be a formality of putting something in the file as compared to having time for a judge to review and sign, is what I would say.
It should create some efficiencies for the court.
Yep.
Okay.
All right, any other questions? Any objection to the motion? So ordered. And so, Senator Bonamici, would you be our carrier on this one?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 2685. And Russ, stay right there. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 2686.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2686 comes to you from the Family Law Section of the Oregon State Bar, abolishes the 90-day waiting period for trial or hearing for dissolution of marriage, requires a party seeking ex parte temporary order for custody or parenting time to file or have pending a motion to set aside or alter any portion of judgment, clarifies the rights and responsibilities of unmarried parents have for their children, applies to proceedings commenced on or after the effective date of this measure.
All right, thank you, Russ.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Russ Lopetsky. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Salem. I'm appearing today on behalf of the Family Law Section of the Oregon State Bar. This bill it comprises a small handful of law improvement and technical fixes to current statute. There are three distinct issues. I'll cover them very briefly. The first is it eliminates the current waiting period that was put into effect back when Oregon moved to a no-fault divorce status. There was some concern at that time about a flood of litigation, and as a result, there was a 90-day mandatory waiting period before a final hearing could take place. This bill would eliminate that 90-day waiting period. As a practical matter, this will primarily affect only those cases in which the parties have come to an agreement and wish to have a judgment entered sooner than 90 days after the case was commenced, because as a practical matter, you're not going to get into court sooner than that for a contested hearing. This again saves some time, money, and paperwork for both the parties and the courts, and we're not aware of any opposition to that provision at all. The second thing this bill does is it requires the parties who are seeking an emergency custody order in court to concurrently have either filed or initiate at that time a standard motion to modify custody. There's an Oregon statute that allows parties to go into court if they can allege an emergency situation that would justify an emergency change of custody to get an emergency temporary order. When someone wants to contest that temporary order, the issues for the court to hear are very limited to whether or not there was an emergency at that time. And what happens sometimes is someone will go in and get an emergency order, but they won't follow through with a standard filing to change custody that would allow the court to consider the best interest of the child in the broader sense, as we normally would in a non-emergency situation. So what this bill does is it says that if you're going to go into court and get an emergency temporary custody order, you have to also file the necessary motion and pleading that will allow the court to consider issues other than simply whether there was an emergency existing at the time the motion was filed. The third issue that this bill covers is it expands the current statute that bootstraps in all of the child custody support and parenting time and custody provisions for divorcing parents and allows those same issues to be dealt with in the court for the non-married parents of children. ORS 109.103 currently says if you have parents that are not married that have children, the provisions of Chapter 107, most of the provisions of Chapter 107 that apply to divorcing couples also apply. So if you're non-married parents and you have to deal with custody issues or you have to deal with child support issues or parenting time issues, under current statute 109.103 is what allows you to incorporate all of the Chapter 107 married parent provisions. However, over the years, as Chapter 107 has been expanded and amended, the provision of Chapter 109 that allows you to bootstrap in those provisions for non-married parents have not concurrently tracked those changes to Chapter 107. So what this bill does, it simply expands ORS 109.103 to incorporate all the changes that have taken place over the last several sessions to Chapter 107 and make sure that we're capturing all those provisions for non-married parents so that their children can be addressed and dealt with by the courts in the same manner as married parents. So those are the issues covered by this bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. Questions? So just for clarification, Russ, the last part is basically updating what currently statutes provide to make certain everything is included that would apply to married couples going through the same type of...
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
All right. Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on 2686? Not seeing anyone, I'm going to close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2686.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2686 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2686 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussions? Any objections? So ordered. Chair will carry 2686 to the floor. We'll close the work session on 2686. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2687A.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2687A also comes to you from the Family Law Section. The bar require a person ordered to pay temporary spousal support to pay the other party rather than the clerk of the court. The court administrator or the Department of Justice allows the court to include the amount of temporary child support to spousal support requested after commencement of the suit, and the general judgment applies to proceedings commenced on or after the effective date of this act. I also want to let the committee know that we have the A3 amendments, which are a conflict amendment, which on page 3 changed the word A to any, so it reads for any child as opposed to currently reading for a child.
All right. Russ.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Russ Lopetsky. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Salem, appearing today on behalf of the Family Law Section of the Oregon State Bar. Senate Bill 2687 addresses two distinct issues. Under current statute, there is very archaic language. It's so archaic that I couldn't really even track how far back it went, that says support is to be paid, child support or spousal support, to the clerk of the court or the court administrator or the Department of Justice. That is long outdated by our current Chapter 25, which has a very set scheme for the payment of support through the Division of Child Support. And what this bill does is it eliminates the language that would have support payments be made to the clerk of the court. The clerks of the court are not handled to accept support payments, and even if you tried to, they would not accept them. This bill has support on a temporary basis, as our orders all do, be paid to the other party, and then there's nothing in the bill that precludes then the establishment of a support case with the department, with the Division of Child Support through the Department of Justice for the enforcement and collection of that support. So it simply cleans up archaic language that, as a practical matter, doesn't happen, and the courts are not equipped to accept those payments, even if you tried to make them through the court. Section 2 of the bill allows the court, in the court's discretion, to retroactively order child support or spousal support during the pendency of a domestic relations case if there's been a motion filed for temporary support or if the petition alleges that support should commence the date the petition was served. Oftentimes, when the parties get to a final hearing, for a number of reasons, there has not been a temporary hearing, so even though you have a legitimate claim for support that is pending before the court, under current statute, unless you have an actual temporary support order, there's no way to capture that amount in a final judgment. That sometimes forces people to ask for court hearings that they would not otherwise ask for the sole purpose of getting their temporary support award. So what the language of the bill does, it allows the court in a general judgment to incorporate any of those temporary support amounts that have been requested but not yet entered by the court. I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you. Questions for Russ? All right. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony on 2687? I'm seeing all close to the public hearing. All right, so here's the situation on this one. We have an A3 which we need to adopt. We do not in our hand have the fiscal on the A3, but we just got a phone call. An email. Okay, so we're printing out the email that says no fiscal on the A3. So why don't we go ahead and do this? Why don't we go ahead and open it up for work session for the adoption of the amendment?
Mr. Chair, I move the adoption of the A3 amendment to House Bill 2687.
Senator Cruz moves the A3 amendment into House Bill 2687. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And at this point, go ahead, or do you want to wait? We'll be here soon. We can come back to it.
Rather than suspend rules, we can wait just a couple minutes.
Yeah, so we're going to close the work session at this time on 2687A. or 27, I guess it's still 2687.
It will be A soon.
And it will be soon.
No, it is A already.
No, it is A already.
It'll be B.
Oh, we're going to make it a B.
Yeah, it will be. That's correct. All right, so move that away and move this one over. And looky here, as we speak, we'll reopen our work session on Senate Bill 2687A.
There we go. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2687A as amended by the, A3 amendments to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 2687A as amended by the A3 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And I'm just doing rotation, Senator Cruz.
It'd be my turn again, wouldn't it? Okay.
Figured you might be able to cover this one.
Okay.
All right, so we'll close the work session on 2687. And we're going to go ahead and open up our, Cruz is the carrier, public hearing on 2689.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2689 comes from the Oregon State Bar. Adds language, the summons for appearance in juvenile court proceedings, that if you are a party to the proceedings, you have the right to appeal a judgment to the Court of Appeals, but must do so no later than 30 days after the enter of the juvenile court's judgment. Actually, Mr. Chair, it comes from the Oregon Law Commission. My mistake.
That's correct. All right. Wendy, looks like you're scheduled, and let me go ahead and sit down. Is there anyone else who will want to give testimony today on 2689? Wendy, when you're ready.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director and General Counsel for the Oregon Law Commission. This bill comes to you with the unanimous support of the Juvenile Code Work Group of the Law Commission, which has been a longstanding work group that works to improve the Juvenile Code, which is 418A, B, and C of the ORS. This bill also comes to you with the unanimous support of the Law Commission and as well as the House. It's a simple cleanup bill. It adds language to the juvenile dependency statute for the summons form to spell out the appeal rights of parents and guardians who are before the juvenile court. It spells out their appeal rights, their right to counsel on appeal, and the timeline for appeal. The summons form is used in a number of juvenile courts as the written notice at first appearance. Some juvenile courts do not have their own standard notice. They're just using the summons form. In the testimony that I've provided to you, it summarizes the issue, but I've also pasted the statute from why we're adding this language. 419B117 requires that parents and guardians before the juvenile court be provided notice at first appearance. And the sub A and B and C and D should be in that notice at first appearance, and present law only provides notice of the sub A and sub B, their obligation to pay for costs of counsel and their support rights. It does not provide notice of the appeal rights. And so this bill on the last page adds in the bold language information regarding their appeal rights. It's a simple cleanup bill. It is really catching up with practice. Because many courts are just using the summons again as the written notice. They're required to both verbally provide notice and provide a written notice, and the written notice presently is often just the summons. So we're just adding language to the summons to make that work in practice. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. We'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 2680.
House Bill.
Excuse me, House Bill 2689. And open a work session on House Bill 2689.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2689 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2689 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Wissett, are you okay with this
one? I think
you
can handle that.
All right. Senator Wissett will be carrier on 2689. Close that work session, and we'll go ahead and open up our last public hearing scheduled for today on 2707.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2707 comes to you from the Interim Committee on Judiciary. It requires a youth who is 15 or 16 years old in charge with a Measure 11 offense away to adult court to be detained in a juvenile detention facility unless the director of the county juvenile department and the sheriff agree to detain the juvenile in jail or other place where adults are detained.
All right. Thank you very much. So, Shannon, I'm not sure if you're going to lead off. I got you, Jasmine, and Karen, so whoever would like to go first.
Thank you, Chair Pozanski, members of the committee. Shannon White with Partnership for Safety and Justice. Partnership for Safety and Justice is an 11-year-old statewide membership organization that advocates for smart public safety policy, both for people who have been victims of crime and for people who've been convicted of crime. To us, it's important to us that our public safety policies are both effective and efficient. We are here today in support of House Bill 2707, which would change the default place of detention for youth who are arrested on adult or Measure 11 charges from the adult jail to a juvenile detention center. This bill comes to you out of the House committee with all but one yes vote. That vote was changed on the House floor publicly, and it had a unanimous vote on the House floor. The reason for this bill juvenile detention centers are better equipped to house youth who have been charged with any kind of crime. Juvenile detention centers often have programming and educational services that can be provided to youth during their pre-trial incarceration. Adult jails, alternatively, are ill-equipped to handle youth, and youth who are housed there are often are at a higher risk of physical and sexual assault. And because of this risk, many adult jails put these youth in isolation cells. Youth are held in isolation cells often for 23 hours a day for the length of their pretrial incarceration, which for a Measure 11 charge can be 3, 6, 9 months, or even a year. For youth with pre-existing mental health disorders, this state of isolation can aggravate existing mental health problems and lead to an increased risk of suicide or attempted suicide. Our current law that allows for youth to be held in adult jail pretrial is inconsistent with laws that we have that allow youth who have been convicted of a Measure 11 crime to stay in an Oregon Youth Authority facility until their 25th birthday. That is under the condition that those youth behave appropriately and participate in programming. This bill likewise would allow discretion within the counties, but would again have the default place of detention be the more appropriate juvenile detention center. This is also consistent with research over the last 10 to 15 years, which has shown that youth who are tried in our adult system and processed through our adult correctional system are actually at an increased risk for committing future crimes. So youth who are held accountable in our juvenile court system are actually more likely to be successful than youth who are put through the adult court system. This was research that was conducted by the Centers for Disease Control and the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention across a number of states that found repeatedly that youth in the adult system actually have an increased risk of committing future crimes. So for these reasons, we're asking for your support for House Bill 2707 to put Oregon further in line with best practices for youth, particularly those youth who are tried under Measure 11 in the adult court system.
All right, thank you. Let's see. I have Jasmine next on the list, but...
Karen, I think we'll go next.
Karen Nibbler. I represent the League of Women Voters of Oregon. Chair Pozanski and Cruz and members of the committee. I did submit a letter to the House Judiciary from the League, and we have a very strong position on keeping juveniles out of adult jails. So I wrote it from that standpoint. But also, I've been a juvenile counselor for 14 years, so I physically put kids in detention and physically took them out of detention. So I have had experience with
Karen,
that.
I'm going to ask you to restate your name. I think I heard you say it, but we want to make sure it got on the record.
Karen Nibbler.
Thank you.
And in the detention facilities, juveniles have access to school and to nurses who can take care of some of their medical or mental health problems. And they also can get out and do some exercise in some of the rec yards. So it's a better situation for them. And in the adult jails, they're more likely to be isolated, and they're exposed to some of the adult offenders. And kids that age are looking for role models. So I don't want them to find role models in adult jails. And if they're in detention facilities, they only have the adult staff for role models. So if they have to stay someplace while they're waiting for trial, we much prefer they stay in a juvenile facility. In addition, it could be that if they're charged with the Measure 11, it will be negotiated down. So they may get a second look or could even be in the juvenile system, and they're more likely to go to a youth correctional facility if they are sentenced. And they could conceivably spend all of their time in juvenile facilities and never move on to DOC. So if we can keep them in the juvenile system all the way through, I think that's the better way to go. So I would encourage you to try to maintain these kids in the juvenile facility if that's appropriate, if they're kids who can, you know, be in a looser facility. So, and also, it's important to fund the detention facilities. And I would encourage all of you to put some money into the juvenile system for those detention facilities so it's possible to have that access.
All right, thank you. Jasmine, you're next. We do have your written testimony, so if you could summarize, that'd be great.
Yeah. My name is Jasmine Missanette, and I'm here in support of House Bill 2707. I'm currently a full-time student at Portland Community College. I serve as a youth member on the Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee, also along with the Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee ensures compliance with the juvenile compliance with federal protections for juveniles. A while ago, I wasn't doing so well as I am right now. I'm here to support House Bill 2707 because I've had experience both in the juvenile facility along with the adult facility. While I was in the juvenile facility, I got the support that I needed along with drug treatment and mental health services and life planning skills. When I was released, I relapsed and was sent to the adult facility where I got no support, no guidance, and was held in a cell 23 hours a day. I saw no hope for myself or my future, and the staff there were not trained to give me any kind of support. Fortunately, I was able to get sent back to the juvenile facility and got additional help and guidance with, you know, getting my life back on track. And I feel that I benefited from being given that second chance. And since then, since my release in 2007, I have enrolled in college. I am pursuing a degree in criminal justice. I am wanting to be a juvenile probation officer because I want to be a part of the system that has helped me. So with that, I'm just in closing my testimony and urge you to support House Bill 2707.
Jennifer, thank you very much for coming forward, or Jasmine, for coming forward with your testimony. Questions? Comments? Thank you all very much for coming forward. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 2707? Jasmine, again, thank you. I know this is not the easiest thing to do, come before a committee. You did wonderful.
Thank you.
All right. No one else? We'll go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2707. And Chair is going to go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 2707.
Mr. Chair, move House Bill 2707 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2707 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Question, Senator Whitson. Mr. Chair, do we have any information from Community Corrections or anybody that has the Corrections community weighed in on this bill in any way?
I was looking to see what we had on the handouts. I did not see anything coming directly from Community Corrections. It seems to be more the advocate groups that have some submitted testimony. Shannon, in fact, maybe you can help us with that question. You need to please put your name back on the record.
Shannon White with Partnership for Safety and Justice. Chair Pozanski, Senator Whitsitt. At the House committee hearing, House Judiciary Committee on this bill, the District Attorneys Association and the juvenile directors supported it as a best practice but are officially neutral on the bill, as was the Sheriff's Association.
Stay right there. Any other questions or comments? Thank you for coming back forward. Bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I have a, on the House side, I have a letter in my file from the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association. It says they take a neutral position.
All right. Any other questions or comments? Any objection to the motion that's before us? Not seeing any. So it passes. Chair will carry House Bill 2707 to the floor. And let's see.
You ran out of bills.
I think we did. Bill's asking for a production bonus for today. We'll take that under advisement. Anything else, Katie?
Go to Ways and Means.
Anything else we need to do? All right. Based on colleagues, just a reminder, tomorrow I expect we're going to have a lot of people here that will give testimony. We'll be trying to start as punctual as we can at 8:30. We'll have a few members and some, invited testimony to begin with, and then we'll open it up for public hearing shortly thereafter. With that, we're adjourned until tomorrow, 8:30.